Chapter 20. Special Problems in the National Economy. Demagoguery beats data in making public policy. Congressman Dick Armey. Economic decisions affect more than the economy. They affect the scope of government power and the growth of government financial obligations, including, but not limited to, the national debt. There are also sometimes misconceptions of the nature of government, leading to unrealistic demands being made on it, followed by hasty denunciations of the stupidity or irrationality of government officials when those demands are not met. To understand many issues in the national economy requires some understanding of political processes as well as economic processes. The scope of government. While some decisions are clearly political decisions and others are clearly economic decisions, there are large areas where choices can be made through either process. Both the government and the marketplace can supply housing, transportation, education, and many other things. For those decisions that can be made either politically or economically, it is necessary not only to decide which particular outcome would be preferred, but also which process offers the best prospect of actually reaching that outcome. This, in turn, requires understanding how each process works in practice, under the respective incentives and constraints, rather than how they should work ideally. The public can express their desires either through choices made in the voting booth or choices made in the marketplace. However, political choices are offered less often and are usually binding until the next election. Moreover, the political process offers package deal choices, where one candidate's whole spectrum of positions on economic, military, environmental, and other issues must be accepted or rejected as a whole, in comparison with another candidate's spectrum of positions on the same range of issues. The voter may prefer one candidate's position on some of these issues and another candidate's position on other issues, but no such choice is available on election day. By contrast, consumers make their choices in the marketplace every day and can buy one company's milk and another company's cheese, or ship some packages by Federal Express and other packages by United Parcel Service. Then they can change their minds a day or a week later and make wholly different choices. As a practical matter, virtually no one puts as much time and close attention into deciding whether to vote for one candidate rather than another as is usually put in deciding what job to take or where to rent an apartment or buy a house. Moreover, the public usually buys finished products in the marketplace, but can choose only among competing promises in the political arena. In the marketplace, the strawberries or the car that you are considering buying are right before your eyes when you make your decision. While the policies that a candidate promises to follow must be accepted more or less on faith, and the eventual consequences of those policies still more so. Speculation is just one aspect of a market economy, but it is the essence of elections. On the other hand, each voter has the same single vote on election day, whereas consumers have very different amounts of dollars with which to express their desires in the marketplace. However, these dollar differences may even out somewhat over a lifetime, as the same individual moves from one income bracket to another over the years, although the differences are there as of any given time. The influence of wealth in the marketplace makes many prefer to move decisions into the political arena, on the assumption that that is a more level playing field. However, among the things that wealth buys is more and better education, as well as more leisure time that can be devoted to political activities and the mastering of legal technicalities. All this translates into a disproportionate influence of wealthier people in the political process, while the fact that those who are not rich often have more money in the aggregate than those who are, may give ordinary people more weight in the market than in the political or legal arena, depending on the issue and the circumstances. Too often, there has been a tendency to regard government as a monolithic decision maker or as the public interest personified. But different elements within the government respond to different outside constituencies and are often in opposition to one another for that reason, as well as because of jurisdictional frictions among themselves. Many things done by government officials in response to the particular incentives and constraints of the situations in which they find themselves may be described as irrational by observers, but are often more rational than the assumption that these officials represent the public interest personified. Politicians like to come to the rescue of particular industries, professions, classes, or racial or ethnic groups from whom votes or financial support can be expected, and to represent the benefits to these groups as net benefits to the country. Such tendencies are not confined to any given country, but can be found in modern democratic states around the world. As a writer in India put it, politicians lack the courage to privatize the huge, loss-making public sector because they are afraid to lose the vote of organized labor. They resist dismantling subsidies for power, fertilizers, and water because they fear the crucial farm vote. They won't touch food subsidies because of the massive poor vote. They will not remove thousands of inspectors in the state governments who continuously harass private businesses because they don't want to alienate government servants' vote bank. Meanwhile, these giveaways play havoc with state finances and add to our disgraceful fiscal deficit. Unless the deficit comes under control, the nation will not be more competitive, nor will the growth rate rise further to 8% and 9%, which is what is needed to create jobs and improve the chances of the majority of our people to actualize their capabilities in a reasonably short time. While such problems may be particularly acute in India, they are by no means confined to India. In 2002, the Congress of the United States passed a farm subsidy bill, with bipartisan support, that has been estimated to cost the average American family more than $4,000 in inflated food prices over the following decade. Huge financial problems have been created in Brazil by such generous pensions to government employees that they can retire in a better economic condition than when they were working. One of the pressures on governments in general, and elected governments in particular, is to do something, even when there is nothing they can do that is likely to make things better, and much that they can do that will risk making things worse. Economic processes, like other processes, take time, but politicians may be unwilling to allow these processes the time to run their course, especially when their political opponents are advocating quick fixes, such as wage and price controls during the Nixon administration, or restrictions on international trade during the Great Depression of the 1930s. In the 21st century, it is virtually impossible politically for any American government to allow a recession to run its course, as American governments once did for more than 150 years prior to the Great Depression, when both Republican President Herbert Hoover and then Democratic President Franklin D. Roosevelt intervened on an unprecedented scale. Today, it is widely assumed as axiomatic that the government must do something when the economy turns down. Very seldom does anyone compare what actually happens when the government does something with what has happened when the government did nothing. The Great Depression. While the stock market crash of October 1929 and the ensuing Great Depression of the 1930s have often been seen as examples of the failure of market capitalism, it is by no means certain that the stock market crash made mass unemployment inevitable. Nor does history show better results when the government decides to do something compared to what happens when the government does nothing. Although unemployment rose in the wake of the record-setting stock market crash of 1929, the unemployment rate peaked at 9% 2 months after the crash, and then began a trend generally downward, falling to 6.3% in June 1930. Unemployment never reached 10% for any of the 12 months following the stock market crash of 1929. But after a series of major and unprecedented government interventions, the unemployment rate soared over 20% for 35 consecutive months. These interventions began under President Herbert Hoover, featuring the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930, the highest tariffs in well over a century, designed to reduce imports so that more American-made products would be sold, thereby providing more employment for American workers. It was a plausible belief, as so many things done by politicians seem plausible. But a public statement, signed by 1,000 economists at leading universities around the country, warned against these tariffs, saying that the Smoot-Hawley bill would not only fail to reduce unemployment, but would be counterproductive. None of this, however, dissuaded Congress from passing this legislation or dissuaded President Hoover from signing it into law in June 1930. Within 5 months, the unemployment rate reversed its decline and rose to double digits for the first time in the 1930s, and it never fell below that level for any month during the entire remainder of that decade, as one massive government intervention after another proved to be either futile or counterproductive. What of the track record when the government refused to do something to counter a downturn in the economy? Since the massive federal intervention under President Hoover was unprecedented, the whole period between the nation's founding in 1776 and the 1929 stock market crash was essentially a do-nothing era as far as federal intervention to counter a downturn. No downturn during that long era was as catastrophic as the Great Depression of the 1930s became, after massive government intervention under both the Hoover administration and the Roosevelt administration that followed. Yet there was a downturn in the economy in 1921 that was initially more severe than the downturn in the 12 months immediately following the stock market crash of October 1929. Unemployment in the first year of President Warren G. Harding's administration was 11.7%. Yet Harding did nothing except reduce government spending as tax revenues declined, the very opposite of what would later be advocated by Keynesian economists. The following year, unemployment fell to 6.7%, and the year after that to 2.4%. Even after it became a political axiom, following the Great Depression of the 1930s, that the government had to intervene when the economy turned down, that axiom was ignored by President Ronald Reagan when the stock market crashed in 1987, breaking the record for a one-day decline that had been set back in 1929. Despite outraged media reaction at his failure to act, President Reagan let the economy recover on its own. The net result was an economy that in fact recovered on its own, followed by what the Economist later called 20 years of an enviable combination of steady growth and low inflation. These were not controlled experiments, of course, so any conclusions must be suggestive rather than definitive. But at the very least, the historical record calls into question whether a stock market crash must lead to a long and deep depression. It also calls into question the larger issue, whether it was the market or the government that failed in the 1930s, and whether a do-something policy must produce a better result than a do-nothing policy. Monetary policy. Even a nominally independent agency, like the Federal Reserve System in the United States, operates under the implicit threat of new legislation that can both counter its existing policies and curtail its future independence. In 1979, the distinguished economist Arthur F. Burns, a former chairman of the Federal Reserve System, looked back on the efforts of the Federal Reserve under his chairmanship to try to cope with a growing inflation. As the Federal Reserve kept testing and probing the limits of its freedom, he said, it repeatedly evoked violent criticism from both the executive establishment and the Congress, and therefore had to devote much of its energy to warding off legislation that could destroy any hope of ending inflation. More fundamental than the problems that particular monetary policies may cause is the difficulty of crafting any policies with predictable outcomes in complex circumstances, when the responses of millions of other people to their perception of a policy can have consequences as serious as the policy itself. Economic problems that are easy to solve as theoretical exercises can be far more challenging in the real world. Merely estimating the changing dimensions of the problem is not easy. Federal Reserve forecasts of inflation during the 1960s and 1970s underestimated how much inflation was developing, under the chairmanship of both William McChesney Martin and Arthur F. Burns. But during the subsequent chairmanships of Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve overestimated what the rate of inflation would be. Even a successful monetary policy is enveloped in uncertainties. Inflation, for example, was reduced from a dangerous 13% per year in 1979 to a negligible 2% by 2003. But this was done through a series of trial and error monetary actions, some of which proved to be effective, some ineffective, and all with painful repercussions on the viability of businesses and on unemployment among workers. As the Federal Reserve tightened money and credit in the early 1980s in order to curb inflation, unemployment rose, while bankruptcies and business failures rose to levels not seen in decades. During this process, Federal Reserve System Chairman Paul Volcker was demonized in the media and President Ronald Reagan's popularity plummeted in the polls for supporting him. But at least Volcker had the advantage that Professor Burns had not had, of having support in the White House. However, not even those who had faith that the Federal Reserve's monetary policy was the right one for dealing with rampant inflation had any way of knowing how long it would take, or whether Congress's patience would run out before then, leading to legislation restricting the Fed's independent authority. One of the governors of the Federal Reserve System during that time later reported his own reactions. Did I get sweaty palms? Did I lie awake at night? The answer is that I did both. I was speaking before these groups all the time, home builders and auto dealers and others. It's not so bad when some guy gets up and yells at you, "USOB, you're killing us." What really got to me was when this fellow stood up and said in a very quiet way, "Governor, I've been an auto dealer for 30 years, worked hard to build up that business. Next week, I am closing my doors." Then he sat down. That really gets to you. The tensions experienced by those who had the actual responsibility for dealing with the real-world problem of inflation were in sharp contrast with the serene self-confidence of many economists in previous years, who believed that economics had reached the point where economists could not merely deal in a general way with recession or inflation problems, but could even fine-tune the economy in normal times. The recommendations and policies of such confident economists had much to do with creating the inflation that the Federal Reserve was now trying to cope with. As a later economist and columnist, Robert J. Samuelson, put it, "As we weigh our economic prospects, we need to recall the lessons of the Great Inflation. Its continuing significance is that it was a self-inflicted wound, something we did to ourselves, with the best of intentions and on the most impeccable of advice. Its intellectual godfathers were without exception men of impressive intelligence. They were credentialed by some of the nation's outstanding universities, Yale, MIT, Harvard, Princeton. But their high intellectual standing did not make their ideas any less impractical or destructive. Scholars can have tunnel vision, constricted by their own political or personal agendas. Like politicians, they can also yearn for the power and celebrity of the public arena. Even if their intentions are pure, their ideas may be mistaken. Academic pedigree alone is no guarantor of useful knowledge and wisdom." Government obligations. In addition to what the government currently spends, it has various legal obligations to make future expenditures. These obligations are specified and quantified in the case of government bonds that must be redeemed for various amounts of money at various future dates. Other obligations are open-ended, such as legal obligations to pay whoever qualifies for unemployment compensation or agricultural subsidies in the future. These obligations are not only open-ended, but difficult to estimate, since they depend on things beyond the government's control, such as the level of unemployment and the size of farmers' crops. Other open-ended obligations that are difficult to estimate are government guarantees of loans made by others to private borrowers or guarantees to those who lend to foreign governments. These guarantees appear to cost nothing, so long as the loans are repaid. And the fact that these guarantees cost the taxpayers nothing is likely to be trumpeted in the media by the advocates of such guarantees, who can point out how businesses and jobs were saved without any expense to the government. But at unpredictable times, the loans do not get paid, and then huge amounts of the taxpayers' money get spent to cover one of these supposedly costless guarantees. When the U.S. government guaranteed the depositors in savings and loan associations that their deposits would be covered by government insurance, this appeared to cost nothing until these savings and loan associations ran up losses of more than $500 billion, the kind of costs incurred in fighting a war for several years, and their depositors were reimbursed by the federal government after these enterprises collapsed. Among the largest obligations of many governments are pensions that have been promised to future retirees. These are more predictable, given the size of the aging population and the mortality rates, but the problem here is that very often there is not enough money put aside to cover the promised pensions. This problem is not peculiar to any given country, but is widespread among countries around the world, since elected officials everywhere benefit at the polls by promising pensions to people who vote, but stand to lose votes by raising tax rates high enough to pay what it would cost to redeem those promises. It is easier to leave it to future government officials to figure out how to deal with the later financial shortfall when the time comes to actually pay the promised pensions. The difference between political incentives and economic incentives is shown by the difference between government-provided pensions and annuities provided by insurance companies. Government programs may be analogized to the activities of insurance companies by referring to these programs as social insurance, but without, in fact, having either the same incentives, the same legal obligations, or the same results as private insurance companies selling annuities. The most fundamental difference between private annuities and government pensions is that the former create real wealth by investing premiums, while the latter create no real wealth but simply use current premiums from the working population to pay current pensions to the retired population. What this means is that a private annuity invests the premiums that come in, creating factories, apartment buildings, or other tangible assets whose earnings will later enable the annuities to be paid to those whose money was used to create these assets. But government pension plans, such as Social Security in the United States, simply spend the premiums as they are received. Much of this money is used to pay pensions to current retirees, but the rest of the money can be used to finance other government activities, ranging from fighting wars to paying for congressional junkets. There is no wealth created in this process to be used in the future to pay the pensions of those who are currently paying into the system. On the contrary, part of the wealth paid into these systems by current workers is siphoned off to finance whatever other government spending Congress may choose. The illusion of investment is maintained by giving the Social Security Trust Fund government bonds in exchange for the money that is taken from it and spent on other government programs. But these bonds likewise represent no tangible assets. They are simply promises to pay money collected from future taxpayers. The country as a whole is not $1 richer because these bonds were printed, so there is no analogy with private investments that create tangible wealth. If there were no such bonds, then future taxpayers would still have to make up the difference when future Social Security premiums are insufficient to pay pensions to future retirees. That is exactly the same as what will have to happen when there are bonds. Accounting procedures may make it seem that there is an investment when the Social Security system holds government bonds, but the economic reality is that neither the government nor anyone else can spend and save the same money. What has enabled Social Security and similar government pension plans in other countries to postpone the day of reckoning is that a relatively small generation in the 1930s was followed by a much larger baby boom generation of the 1940s and 1950s. Because the baby boom generation earned much higher incomes and therefore paid much larger premiums into the Social Security system, the pensions promised to the retirees from the previous generation could easily be paid. Not only could the promises made to the 1930s generation be kept, additional benefits could be voted for them, with obvious political advantages to those awarding these additional benefits. With the passage of time, however, a declining birth rate and an increasing life expectancy reduced the ratio of people paying into the system to people receiving money from the system. Unlike a private annuity, where premiums paid by each generation create the wealth that will later pay for its own pensions, government pensions pay the pensions of the retired generation from the premiums paid by the currently working generation. That is why private annuities are not jeopardized by the changing demographic makeup of the population, but government pension plans are. Government pension plans enable current politicians to make promises which future governments will be expected to keep. These are virtually ideal political conditions for producing generous pension benefits and future financial crises resulting from those generous benefits. Nor are such incentives and results confined to the United States. Countries of the European Union likewise face huge financial liabilities as the size of their retired populations continues to grow, not only absolutely, but also relative to the size of the working populations whose taxes are paying their pensions. Moreover, the pensions in European Union countries tend to be more readily available than in the United States. In Italy, for example, working men retire at an average age of 61, and those working in what are defined as arduous occupations, miners, bus drivers, and others, retire at age 57. The cost of this generosity consumes 15% of the country's gross domestic product, and Italy's national debt in 2006 was 107% of the country's GDP. Belatedly, Italy raised the minimum retirement age to 59. As France, Germany, and other European countries began to scale back the generosity of their government pension policies, political protests caused even modest reforms to be postponed or trimmed back. But neither the financial nor the political costs of these government pensions were paid by the generation of politicians who created these policies decades earlier. Local governments operate under much the same set of political incentives as national governments, so it is not surprising that employees of local governments and of enterprises controlled or regulated by local governments often have very generous pensions. Not only may employees of New York's Long Island Railroad, run by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, retire in their 50s, the vast majority of these retirees also receive disability payments in addition to their pensions, even though most made no disability claims while working, but only after retiring. In 2007, for example, 94% of career employees who retired from the Long Island Railroad after age 50 then received disability benefits, according to the New York Times. Far from reflecting work hazards, these post-retirement disability claims are part of a whole web of arcane work rules under union contracts that permit employees to collect 2 days' pay for 1 day's work and permitted one engineer to collect 5 times his base salary 1 year and later be classified as disabled after retirement, according to the New York Times. In Brazil, government pensions are already paying out more money than they are taking in, with the deficits being especially large in the pensions for unionized government employees. In other words, the looming financial crisis, which American and European governments are dreading and trying to forestall, has already struck in Brazil, whose government pensions have been described as the most generous in the world. According to The Economist, civil servants do not merely retire on full salary, they get, in effect, a pay rise because they stop paying contributions into the system. Most women retire from government service at around 50, and men soon afterwards. A soldier's widow inherits his pension and bequeaths it to her daughters. Given that Brazil's civil servants are an organized and unionized special interest group, such generosity is understandable politically. The question is whether the voting public in Brazil and elsewhere will understand the economic consequences well enough to be able to avoid the financial crises to which such unfunded generosity can lead, in the name of social insurance. Such awareness is beginning to dawn on people in some countries. In New Zealand, for example, a poll found that 70% of New Zealanders under the age of 45 believe that the pensions they have been promised will not be there for them when they retire. In one way or another, the day of reckoning seems to be approaching in many countries for programs described as social insurance, but which were in fact never insurance at all. Such programs not only fail to create wealth, the more generous retirement plans may in fact lessen the rate at which wealth is created by enabling people to retire while they are still quite capable of working and thus adding to the nation's output. For example, while 62% of the people in the 55 to 64-year-old bracket in Japan are still working, and 60% in the United States, only 41% of the people in that age bracket are still working in the countries of the European Union. It is not just the age at which people retire that varies from country to country. How much their pensions pay, compared to how much they made while working, also varies greatly from one country to another. While pensions in the United States pay about 40% of pre-retirement earnings, and those in Japan less than 40%, pensions in the Netherlands and Spain pay about 80%, and in Greece, 96%. No doubt that has something to do with when people choose to stop working. It also has something to do with the financial crises that struck some European Union countries in the early 21st century. While the United States has long lagged behind European industrial nations in government-provided or government-mandated benefits, it has in more recent years been increasing such benefits rapidly. Unemployment insurance benefits, which used to end after 26 weeks in the United States, have been extended to 99 weeks. Other alternatives to working have also increased in their utilization. Disability pay under Social Security insurance, for example. Barely 3 million Americans received work-related disability checks from Social Security in 1990, a number that had changed only modestly in the preceding decade or two. Since then, the number of people drawing disability checks has soared, passing 5 million by 2000, 6.5 million by 2005, and rising to nearly 8.6 million today. Market failure and government failure. The imperfections of the marketplace, including such things as external costs and benefits, as well as monopolies and cartels, have led many to see government interventions as necessary and beneficial. Yet the imperfections of the market must be weighed against the imperfections of the government whose interventions are prescribed. Both markets and governments must be examined in terms of their incentives and constraints. The incentives facing government enterprises tend to result in very different ways of carrying out their functions compared to the way things are done in a free market economy. After banks were nationalized in India in 1969, for example, uncollectible debts rose to become 20% of all loans outstanding. Efficiency also suffered. An Indian entrepreneur reported that, "It takes my wife half an hour to make a deposit or withdraw money from our local branch." Moreover, government ownership and control led to political influence in deciding to whom bank loans were to be made. I once chanced to meet the manager of one of the rural branches of a nationalized bank. He was a sincere young man, deeply concerned, and he wanted to unburden himself about his day-to-day problems. Neither he nor his staff, he told me, decided who qualified for a loan. The local politicians invariably made this decision. The loan takers were invariably cronies of the political bosses and did not intend to repay the money. He was told that such and such a person was to be treated as a deserving poor. Without exception, they were rich. The nationalization of banks in India was not simply a matter of transferring ownership of an enterprise to the government. This transfer changed all the incentives and constraints from those of the marketplace to those of politics and bureaucracy. The proclaimed goals, or even the sincere hopes of those who created this transfer, often turned out to mean much less than the changed incentives and constraints. These incentives and constraints were changed again after India began to allow private banks to operate. As the Wall Street Journal reported, the country's growing middle class is taking most of its business to the high-tech private banks, thereby leaving the state banks with the least profitable businesses and worst borrowers. The people in the private sector may not have been much different from those in government, but they operated under very different incentives and constraints. In the United States, political control of banks' investment decisions has been less pervasive, but has nevertheless changed the directions that investments have taken from what they would take in a free market. As the Wall Street Journal reported, regulators whose approval is needed for mergers are taking a harder line on banks and savings and loans performance under the Community Reinvestment Act, a law that requires them to lend in every community where they take deposits. A weak lending record can slow or even derail a deal, while a strong one can speed approval and head off protests by community groups. In other words, people with neither expertise nor experience in financial institutions, politicians, bureaucrats, and community activists, are enabled to influence where investments are to go. Yet, when financial institutions began to have huge losses in 2007 and 2008 on subprime loans, Citigroup losing more than $40 billion, politicians were seldom blamed for having pushed these institutions to lend to people whose credit was below par. On the contrary, precisely those same politicians who had been most prominent in pushing lenders to take chances were now most prominent in fashioning solutions to the resulting crises, based on their experience on congressional banking committees and therefore presumed expertise in dealing with financial matters. As an entrepreneur in India put it, "Indians have learned from painful experience that the state does not work on behalf of the people. More often than not, it works on behalf of itself." So do people in other walks of life and in other countries around the world. The problem is that this fact is not always recognized when people look to government to right wrongs and fulfill desires to an extent that may not always be possible. Whatever the merits or demerits of particular government economic policies, the market alternative is very new as history is measured, and the combination of democracy and a free market still newer and rarer. As an observer in India put it, "We tend to forget that liberal democracy based on free markets is a relatively new idea in human history. In 1776, there was one liberal democracy, the United States. In 1790, there were three, including France. In 1848, there were only five. In 1975, there were still only 31. Today, 120 of the world's 200 or so states claim to be democracies, with more than 50% of the world's population residing in them, although Freedom House, an American think tank, counts only 86 countries as truly free. Where there are elected governments, their officials must be concerned about being re-elected, which is to say that mistakes cannot be admitted and reversed as readily as they must be by a private business operating in a competitive market in order for the business to survive financially. No one likes to admit being mistaken, but under the incentives and constraints of profit and loss, there is often no choice but to reverse course before financial losses threaten bankruptcy. In politics, however, the costs of the government's mistakes are often paid by the taxpayers, while the costs of admitting mistakes are paid by elected officials. Given these incentives and constraints, the reluctance of government officials to admit mistakes and reverse course is perfectly rational from those officials' standpoint. For example, when supersonic passenger jet planes were first contemplated by both private plane manufacturers like Boeing and by the British and French governments who proposed building the Concorde, it became clear early on that the costs of fuel-guzzling supersonic passenger jets would be so high that there would be little hope of recovering those costs from fares that passengers would be willing to pay. Boeing dropped the whole idea, absorbing the losses of its early efforts as a lesser evil than continuing on and absorbing even bigger losses by completing the project. But the British and French governments, once publicly committed to the idea of the Concorde, continued on instead of admitting that it was a bad idea. The net result was that British and French taxpayers for years subsidized a commercial venture used largely by very affluent passengers, because fares on the Concorde were far higher than fares on other jets flying the same routes, even though these very expensive fares still did not fully cover the costs. Eventually, as Concordes aged, the plane was discontinued because its huge losses were now so widely known that it would have been politically difficult, if not impossible, to get public support for more government spending to replace planes that had never been economically viable. Although we often speak of the government as if it were a single thing, it is not only fragmented into differing and contending interests at any given time, its leadership consists of entirely different people over time. Thus, those who put an end to the costly Concorde experiment were not the same as those who had launched this experiment in the first place. It is always easier to admit someone else's mistakes and to take credit for correcting them. In a competitive market, by contrast, the costs of mistakes can quickly become so high that there is no choice but to admit one's own mistakes and change course before bankruptcy looms on the horizon. Because the day of reckoning comes earlier in markets than in government, there is not only more pressure to admit mistakes in the private sector, there is more pressure to avoid making mistakes in the first place. When proposals for new ventures are made in these different sectors, proposals made by government officials need only persuade enough people in order to be successful within the time horizon that matters to those officials, usually the time until the next election. In a competitive market, however, proposals must convince those particular people whose own money is at stake, and who therefore have every incentive to marshal the best available expertise to assess the future before proceeding. It is hardly surprising that these two processes can produce very different conclusions about the very same situations. Thus, when the proposal for building a tunnel under the English Channel was being considered, the British and French governments projected costs and earnings that made it look like a good investment, at least to enough of the British and French public to make the venture politically viable. Meanwhile, companies running ferry service across the English Channel obviously thought otherwise, for they proceeded to invest in more and bigger ferries, which could have been financial suicide if the tunnel under the Channel had turned out to be the kind of success that was projected by political officials, for that would lead people to take the underwater route across the Channel instead of ferries. Only after years of building and more years of operation did the economic outcome of the tunnel project become clear, and the British and French officials initially responsible for this venture were long gone from the political scene by then. In 2004, The Economist reported, "Without a doubt, the Channel Tunnel would not have been built if we'd known about these problems," Richard Shirriffs, the chief executive of Eurotunnel, said this week. "Too few people are using the 10-year-old undersea link between Britain and France to repay even the interest on its bloated construction costs, which have left Eurotunnel with $11.5 billion in debt. So, just as happened with supersonic Concorde, taxpayers are being asked to bail out another Anglo-French transport fiasco. None of this will come as a surprise to tunnel skeptics, who, like Concorde's, were mostly ignored. While these examples involved the British and French governments, similar incentives and constraints, and similar results, apply to many governments around the world. Sometimes, however, the short memory of the voting public can spare elected officials the consequences of having advocated a policy that has either failed or has quietly been abandoned. For example, in the United States, both individual states and the federal government have imposed gasoline taxes dedicated to the building and maintenance of highways, and both have later diverted these taxes to other things. In 2008, Congress passed a bill to spend hundreds of billions of dollars for the purpose of preventing financial institutions from collapsing. Yet before the year was out, those Treasury Department officials in charge of disbursing this money openly admitted that much of it was diverted to bailing out other firms in other industries. None of this is new or peculiar to the United States. As far back as 1776, Adam Smith warned that a fund set aside by the British government for paying off the national debt was an obvious and easy expedient to be misapplied to other purposes.